Life is really unpredictable sometimes. If you read my recent open letter published on my website, thewellreadmage.com, then you know a bit about what's been going on in my life and how 2020 turned me down a road I ended up not wanting to walk. But well before 2020, I played a little Korean MMO you might have heard of called Dungeon Fighter Online. Now actually, you might not have heard of it at all, and I wouldn't blame you. But I never knew that someday I'd have the opportunity to talk about it at length with my special guest this time. That guest is J.R. Sommerfeldt, a pastor, counselor, thanatologist, longtime gamer, indie enthusiast, podcaster, and streamer. Together we had a conversation that struck me as surprising, just as surprising as life itself. That is unpredictable and constantly shifting and evolving. Sometimes in conversation we call this going on a rant or going on rabbit trails, but that's not quite what this is. Neither is it quite fair to the nature of natural conversation to call it that. And you know what? This episode made me realize how much I missed having real, in-depth, serious conversations about video games. That's what MageCast is for. I lost sight of that with this show being on break for so long, so I am glad to be in the thick of it again. Here's our conversation on Dungeon Fighter Online, aka DFO. Welcome to MageCast, my friends. I think that you're in for a treat this time. You're always in for a treat. Come on, this is MageCast. But it's a special kind of treat this time. I'm talking with a guest that I've never had on the show before, one. And also, secondly, we're going to be talking about a game that's rather obscure. We're not going to be doing the Super Mario Worlds or the Sonic the Hedgehogs or The Last of Us or anything like that. We're going to talk about a game that not too many people evidently know about. In fact, when I announced that we were going to do this game as our subject for this episode, there were a couple of people who were like, huh, I never heard of it. And that was almost the title of this episode as well. But you could hear the chuckling of my guest here. I'm pleased to welcome JR. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good, Red. How you doing, man?
Yeah, doing great. It's been a heck of a year. But
it has. Yeah. It has. That's putting it very lightly, actually.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, it's a family-friendly podcast.
That's true. That's
can't
true.
Say more. But yeah, you and I have been planning this episode for a long time. I'm glad to have you. And I was wondering if you could just kind of tell our audience a little bit more about yourself and just kind of introduce us to
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Well, my name is J.R. Sommerfeldt, and that's kind of what I go on with Twitter and everything like that. Everybody kind of knows me as that. My first name's Jason, so you can call me Jason if you want to, but we just go by JR. That's fine. Mm-hmm. And I am a lifelong gamer. I have been playing games since, oh my goodness, I think the first video game that I ever actually played was Dig Dug in the arcade.
Nice.
And my dad had to lift me up in order to play it on the arcade cabinet. So,
that's okay,
right. All right. And so I've been playing video games for a very long time, kind of passing that down to my family. I'm a pastor. I'm a counselor. I am a certified thanatologist.
Okay. Thanatologist.
Thanatologist.
Now, you and I know what that is, but what is a thanatologist for the sake of those who are scratching?
It is not the study of Marvel superheroes, I can tell you that.
Thanos.
It is actually death counseling. And so I work a lot with individuals who are on the edge of death, or that are their families for bereavement and comfort and everything like that. And so it's really, really, it can be sad, yes, but it is a very, very, it's a very good profession to be in. So very rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of one of the things that I do. But, you know, on my time off, I do play games. I am a streamer. I do my stream on Twitch on Wednesdays, or on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And I really focus around indies. I'm kind of a really big indie guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I play a lot of indie games. And the one that I'm currently working with right now is Spiritfarer.
Yes. So I recall, and I think this kind of ties into your thanatology as well.
It does.
That when Spiritfarer was announced, we were talking about, possibly reviewing it, and then you were interested in playing it on your stream. And one of the reasons why you wanted to do that was because specifically the game deals with the theme of death. And
it's a cozy management game about dying. That's seriously what it is. It's basically, if Animal Crossing was on the ferry of death, going across and taking all the animals to the afterlife. I mean, basically, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And so it's a really neat idea for a game. It's an indie game, and on top of that, I also help out with Indie World Order, which is a group of indie developers that kind of all meet together, and I help promote all of their games. So on Fridays, I actually do an active beta test of games. And some of these are really good. Some of these need a little bit of work. And the developer gets to watch me play their game.
Oh, that's and cool. So that's helpful, I imagine.
It really is. It really is. And they really do enjoy it. And I'm never hard on them because, hey, indie developers, they usually are the only people that do this by themselves.
Right. And I think that sort of feedback is probably really healthy for, you know, I consider gaming, video games an art form, and with that comes a lot of different kinds of traits and skills and qualities, and being able as an artist to have that opportunity to receive feedback, from somebody who's genuine, from somebody who's not going to, demonize instead of criticize. Is I'm sure just not just good for the developer, but then good for the eventual players, because then the developer gets to take that feedback and make a better game.
Right. And that's exactly what happens. And so I get to see kind of the end product. And so it's really nice. Over the years, I've been able to do a few of these beta test games. In fact, one of the beta tests I did was for a game that's coming out on the Switch, just came out, called Death and Taxes.
Cool.
And pretty cool.
But then it's there in the title. So what do you play as, Ben Franklin or what?
No. No, you play as the Grim Reaper with a desk job.
Oh.
Yeah, it's actually pretty neat.
Huh. Sounds like Grim Fandango almost.
Yeah, sort of.
Did you play that one?
I have.
Okay.
I have.
I was going to say that falls right in line with your thanatology.
It kind of does. Yeah.
And I love that game. Well, anyway, thank you. So tonight we're going to talk about Mage Cast. I'm sorry, tonight. That threw me off. It's afternoon.
it's whenever the listeners listen
yeah,
to
yeah.
it. Good day, everyone.
Yes. For this episode of Mage Cast, episode 51, we're going to be talking about Dungeon Fighter Online. Title of our episode is DFO versus the World. Dungeon Fighter Online was developed by Neopol, or Neopol? How do you say that?
I always call it Neopol.
Neopol, yeah.
Yeah, I always call it Neopol.
I was looking at it, I was like, I hope it's not supposed to be pronounced like people, because I'm not going to pronounce it that way. Neopol?
Yeah.
No.
You can pronounce it how you want to, I suppose.
There you go, yeah. Nobody from South Korea is listening anyway, so.
You don't know that.
Right? Okay, so Neopol is a South Korean subsidiary of Nexon. And Dungeon Fighter Online was officially released in 2005 in South Korea and in the U.S. in 2009. By the way, folks, I've got to let you know, this is a spoilers podcast. So here's the thing. I don't think you're going to be playing this game for the story, and we're going to get into that a little bit later. This is an MMO, but it seems like it's very much about the gameplay. But if you are somebody who's like, I cannot play any game if I get spoilers, then just be forewarned that we're going to talk a little bit about the story and obviously a lot about the classes and things like that. So,
and for the listeners, because I know that, you know, the community that we have here, they're hardcore gamers and everything like that. But just in case, what is an MMO?
Ooh, massively. I haven't played one for a while. Massively. Shoot. You said massively multiplayer online.
Yes, experience. It is an acronym in bad English. It's massively multiplayer online, and then you put RPG in there, role playing game.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. So recently too, we put out the kind of, you know, what are some of your favorite MMOs? Based on that description, I was sort of at a loss. I was like, is Monster Hunter World an MMO? What do you think? Did you play Monster Hunter?
No, I have. I played a lot of Monster Hunter, not a lot of Monster Hunter World. But,
okay. The same thing, pretty much.
I almost put it in the same realm as Diablo.
Okay.
You know, like the Diablo 2 and Diablo 3, where you can play with a bunch of people. Mm-hmm. But it's more based on smaller server bases. Like, when we're looking at, like, massively multiplayer online games, I'm talking, like, hundreds of people in the same server. Crawling all over the world.
Right. So that sort of seems to be what's missing from the Monster Hunter formula is the massively part.
Right. I mean, you can still play with anybody that you want, but it's not like the hub itself doesn't have like a whole tons of people. Like I play Dauntless, you know, which is like the Monster Hunter knockoff. Mm-hmm. And that one is also in the same way. You get just a few people in the server, but you can pretty much play with anybody you want in the any given instance that you go into, which is the special fights against the monsters and things like that.
Mm. So maybe we need a little, like a different term for that, like moderately multiplayer.
Moderately multiplayer, yeah.
Cool. Well, anyway, let's get into some mage facts here. And we'll kind of take turns on these like we were chatting about.
Yeah.
So Dungeon Fighter Online is a fairly unique MMO, which combines 2D side-scrolling beat-em-up gameplay with RPG elements. Now, obviously, that's a massive generalization. There's a lot to this game.
There is.
But I think that's one of the things that interested me in the game, first of all. And I think it's a real good hook, because there's so many MMOs. And so for me, it was like, ooh, beat-em-up gameplay in an MMO? I'll play.
Mm-hmm. And it contains 16 playable base classes, which is male slayer, female slayer, male fighter, female fighter, male gunner, female gunner, male mage, female mage, male priest, female priest, thief, knight, demonic lancer, agent, dark knight, and creator. And by the way, the male and female variants are different classes. They're not the same class. Like they kind of are, like, in the beginning, mm-hmm. but they are a different class because those are the base classes. Mm-hmm. There are also, I like to call them subclasses that you can choose, like specializations. And we'll kind of get into that here in a mm-hmm. little bit.
Yeah. And that is, it's an interesting thing to take note of. At first I was like, should I write all these out? It almost sounds like they're different skins of the same thing, but they're definitely not. And that's what I remembered from this game too, is there's significant differences. Nexon shut down the North American servers in 2013 before Neopol later reopened them in 2015.
So, and this is something we're probably going to talk about a little bit more here on this Magecast, because this is almost a par for the course for Nexon. Not so much for Neopol, but, and that's the thing, Neopol is Nexon. So, I mean, you really can't, you know... This is something that happens a lot with this group, with Nexon, and there's reasons why. Yeah, because, I mean, you know, when you talk about Nexon, it's not just DFO. There's other games that have come on there that are very popular.
Oh, yeah.
Let me read this one. DFO is one of the most played and highest grossing single video games of all time. That you've never heard of. By 2019, it had reached 600 million players and had grossed over about $13.4 billion.
Humongous.
Humongous. I know that you put a Twitter poll on this. What was the final percentage of people that in our community that had not heard of this game?
You know what? That's a great question. I actually forgot about that poll. Let me look it up real quick.
I've been watching it. Because, I mean, when you look at, you know, something like this, you've got this astronomic game. Because there's a list online of the 50 highest grossing video game franchises of all time. And of course, like at the very top, now this is not just selling games or microtransactions or anything like that. This is like actual merchandise and everything like that.
Right.
You know what the number one is? Number one, and it probably won't be dethroned anytime soon, is Pokemon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was a distinction that we needed to like consciously navigate when we spent a little bit of time kind of looking at what are the best selling video game franchises. What we found is some lists interpreted best selling video game franchise as the games plus merch plus tie-ins plus spin-offs plus all of that stuff. Then some lists went and interpreted it as just the games and the revenue from just the games. So it seems like what we found was if you look at the entire franchise, including all the exterior media, then it's Pokemon at the top. And mm-hmm. then if you look at lists that just list just the revenue from the games, then it's Mario at the top.
Yeah.
And that makes sense. I mean, Mario's had like a billion games over the years.
Right, but if you're looking at the list that has all of the merch, because, you know, this gaming franchise isn't just a gaming franchise. When it was released in South Korea, they almost immediately started working on an anime series and then a manga series. And then, you know, I mean, who knows how far it's going to go.
Right, and that was the very next mage fact right there. It works perfectly. The game inspired... multiple anime, apparently,
mm-hmm.
Manga, and even a webcomic. And these range from adaptations to loosely based material, evidently.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And, I mean, if you hop on DeviantArt, you'll find even more inspiration.
That's true,
so,
yeah.
I wouldn't do that, but, you know, you get on there, you know.
That's funny.
I never know what you'll find.
No, it being DeviantArt. It's in the title. One thing that I did want to mention with the two kinds of lists that we saw, we consistently found DFO ranking in like the top 10 on these lists.
Yeah, in the one where it's all merchandise, it was 7. And I think if it was just the game, like with microtransactions, because by the way, this is a free-to-play game.
Right.
So this is not one of those things where it's like, you know, you have to actually purchase the actual game itself.
Right. So I would be very interested to know what is the average amount of money that the average player is spending on DFO.
And that all depends, honestly, on where you are, because there are four major groupings of this game. You have China, South Korea, Japan, and then global. Okay, and that's like separating into different servers. And so you have the global servers, or us,
mm-hmm.
all right? And we're the ones that I almost feel like Neopal looks at us as kind of being an afterthought.
Mm.
And so not, you know, I mean, it's a business, right? And we'll get into that here in a little bit. But it depends on where you're at, because in China, that's all the rage.
Mm-hmm.
Is purchasing these items on the game. And the way the game is set up is you get something called fatigue points, which the more that you amass, or you say the more you lose, you won't be able to level as fast. You know, you won't be able to progress to the end game as fast. So you have to buy certain items with actual money to progress a little bit faster. And so, depending on the culture, if it's a culture that's like, man, DFO is the best, DFO is life, DFO is what it's all about, then they're going to be pushing that a lot more than if it's over here, what in the heck is DFO?
Mm.
I've never heard of DFO,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so, Neopal kind of has, and Nexon really, has kind of created this culture, you could say, of depending on where you're at and what servers you are on, they push these purchases a little bit more. And so there's a big cultural difference here.
And could you say that part of that cultural difference might be the fact that at least in North America, it seems like there's a very, very, very negative reception toward microtransactions. Almost like they're a naughty word.
Yep.
Like, you bring up microtransactions, and I've seen some people have some takes on microtransactions. So I wonder if there's a cultural difference then between how receptive these different servers are towards that kind of business model.
As an American, I mean, I can't speak for other countries mm-hmm. that have this, but from what we've seen, from how much comes from these microtransactions in different countries, I would almost say yes. Mm-hmm. You know, because I mean, the proof is in the pudding. Even if you don't know how the culture is facilitating this. There was one Reddit post that I had read. It was absolutely fantastic. I hate Reddit, by the way. I'm not a big fan of it. I don't.
Neither am I.
But there is some good stuff in there, especially when people are knowledgeable and informed. Mm-hmm. And they had said, one person was like, how come we've never really heard of this game over here? Mm. How come it's like big in other countries and all that? And the one person said, it's all about China. And then he put a bunch of dollar signs right after it, because China, apparently, if you want to be good at this game, the culture there, the culture of players there, basically has you need to have the best gear. You need to have the best look. Mm-hmm. All right. And that means like the best skins.
Yeah. Cosmetics, all that.
You need to represent really, really well, because you're not getting in our raid party if you don't have this. We call it elitist, but over there, it's serious stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is serious stuff. They've got groups that compete against each other in order to beat a raid at a certain time. It's like an esport. Mm-hmm. You know, and esports over there are also very, very big.
Right.
And so that culturally, we Americans do not put as much stock into that. In fact, we look at microtransactions as stealing
right.
from the people, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. especially when it's a game where you have to have a microtransaction to win.
Right. And I think that illustrates a couple of points about microtransactions, which we might as well just move our discussion about microtransactions to this point.
Well, I mean, we're yeah. already there, and yeah, we'll get into that.
Yeah. And I think, too, that'll probably be a big barrier for a lot of people as to whether should I play this game or not. And
you might hear,
oh, it has microtransactions, it's free to play. That's a no from me. But I think that it bears saying that, and what I want to say is I'm not being a microtransaction apologist right now. I'm not defending microtransactions. But what I am saying is that there are different ways of implementing microtransactions, and there are different kinds of microtransactions. When I played this game, I did spend real money on it, but mm-hmm. I did so pretty much exclusively just for like cosmetic stuff.
For skin.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I bought myself some scarves and things like that, and some different sorts of suits and the glowy bits that you get in MMOs and things like that, because I thought it looked cool, and I was playing it almost exclusively at the time. So, and that to me is, this is an option. You don't have to buy this in order to succeed or in order to move forward. But if you're coming at the game in that kind of casual sense with that option, fine, that's one thing. It's another thing to kind of lock your game, half your game, two-thirds of your game behind those things. Yeah. And then it's another thing if you're part of sort of an esports culture or scene to yes. approach those things in that regard. So I think that microtransactions as a discussion is something where there's a lot of noise, there's a lot of anger even.
I mean, there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. As you know, and as I've kind of talked to you about this, is I am a huge World of Warcraft fan.
Mm-hmm.
I am. So, you know, people out there, don't hold that against me. Even if you do, I'm not going to stop.
Right.
Because it's something that my wife and I play together. We've been playing it for 14 years. No, 15
Isn't
years.
That, you said that's how you met. Is that right?
It's not how we met. No.
Okay.
It's how we, and honestly, it helped us to kind of solidify our marriage. Now, of course, we're Christians and all that, and so it was solidified by our common faith and our values and all that. But really, when it came to date nights and stuff like that, we didn't have a lot of money. Mm. Man, that's what we did.
There you go.
We played World of Warcraft.
And cheaper still, than going to a movie.
Yeah, and we fired it up last night, too, and played it. And, I mean, it's really... The thing about microtransactions, this is what I do. When my wife's birthday comes around, and there's a mount on, you know, like a riding mount that you can get on World of Warcraft, and it's on sale or something like that on the Warcraft store, I'll buy it, and I can send it to her as a little gift with a little, it's got a little box with a wrapping on it and everything. It's like all virtual, and you just open it up in your mailbox and take it out. It's like, happy birthday, honey. Here's your fairy dragon. You know, so, I mean, yeah, that is kind of, that's the idea that we have in America, like with transactions. When we look at microtransactions, we're like, okay, that's fine. Mm-hmm. That's fine. But... when we go into a mobile game, and by the way, there are people, some people believe this, and I think that there's some merit to this, that DFO, the model of microtransactions that DFO employs, and it employed it all the way back a little bit after 2005, that it employs is a model that current day mobile phone games use. So DFO may have been kind of the starter or the catalyst,
really,
for what you could say is kind of the modern day mobile gaming microtransaction thing that you deal with. Because like with the fatigue points, mm-hmm. you know, with some mobile games, it's like, well, you've gotten this far, and you can definitely get a little bit farther, but you're going to have to wait 24 hours for yeah. your bar to fill back up.
Right. Now that sounds a lot like what some of the games like my kids are playing. They'll play mm-hmm. Mario Run or Dr. Mario World, I think it is. I've never played any of those. The only game that I'm playing right now that has microtransactions is Pokemon Go.
I only play it
once in a while. But the thing with that is you got to go out and take a walk if you want to get the Pokeballs and the Pokemon and things like that. But if you want to skip the walk... then you can just pay some real money and get some balls. Yeah.
You can pay your way into making it look like you've done a lot of cardio in order to get to where you're going.
Right? Have not. So, well, that's interesting to note that DFO may have been the originator of those.
It is believed that it's one of the first parts of that model that kind of came out with all of that. And it makes a lot of sense because then all of a sudden smartphones started getting popular. And then you started to see that a little bit more. DFO was doing that long before that happened.
Interesting. Well, why don't we get into some personal experience here?
Sure, sure.
And sort of turn away from the technical for a moment. And we'll return to that, I think, towards the end. First of all, how did you first hear about DFO? And when did you start playing it?
Well, I started playing DFO all the way back in 2000, probably around 2009, 2010.
Okay.
And I found out about the game because of a little blurb that was on a Game Informer. I was just looking through my Game Informer that I got from, you know, GameStop and just flipping through it. And I saw this, it was like maybe, I think it was like two images of the mm-hmm. game, like the gameplay, and I looked at it and I was like, oh, this looks awesome.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, and it was just a small blurb. It wasn't really anything that really went into detail. Almost like it was like, yeah, this is a game that's coming out of South Korea, big whoop. But it had been out since 2005. Mm-hmm. We were just getting it in 2009. So that's how I first heard about the game.
I see. So for me, I shortly played it after getting married, and my wife and I were working opposite schedules, so I had a lot of time to myself, and I was off on weekdays, and she'd be working, so I was like, well, what am I going to do with my life? And so I decided to make that video games, and I was like, you know, I want things that are going to have some kind of longevity to them. I think at the time I didn't even have a PS3, so it was just, this is 2011, and I had a lot of just retro consoles. I went peeking around online, seeing kind of what are the free-to-play games and the MMOs that were all the rage, and I ran into Nexon. I played Vindictus for a little bit.
I think
I played a little bit of Mabinogi.
See, now that one I'm not too familiar with, but I've heard of it.
Looking at it, I mean, it might have changed since a decade ago, but it looks like one that I did play, and I have a terrible memory, so I apologize. But Maple Story would have been the one that I got into next.
There it is, Maple Story.
Which, as I remarked to you, I'm glad I didn't, because I think I just would have probably played Maple Story for a
Maple
decade.
Maple Story. That was the other one. There were really three at the time, and it was Warcraft, DFO, and Maple Story. And Maple Story is another Nexon game. It's still going strong today. There is still a hard fan base in America for Maple Story.
So this is how I discovered Nexon. I was on Facebook and people were using Maple Story imagery. And I was like, what is this from? Because it looks like something that I might enjoy. So
it's a retro style. It's exactly what Nexon was doing back in those days. Yeah. Was creating games with a retro style.
Yeah. And looking at it, I was like, I could get into this. I mean, it looks messy and some of that's intimidating to me, where there's so much information and so many characters on a screen at once, and that's very much like an MMO kind of a thing and to my mind. So from then I started looking at Nexon's roster, and I bumped into Dungeon Fighter Online, and same thing as you, I saw our first few images and I was like, this looks super cool. And the fact that you could just play it right then, on a computer free to play, sealed the deal.
And I think it still kind of continues this. It's a browser game, like, gone are the days of the browser games. Well, this one's still kind of going pretty strong, and honestly, it still looks good. It has that retro aesthetic still.
Right, and there's something to say about that aesthetic. If you're attempting realism, that's going to age.
Yes.
It just is, because the technology that's pushing realism is going to improve and going to improve. And so if you're doing something like the retro aesthetic, which I've in the past compared to the impressionist movement in painting, you're capturing the sense of something rather than the way that thing actually is. So when you look at like a character in DFO, their little pixel sprite, like, it resembles a human, but there's a lot that's cartoonish about it, and there's a lot that your brain kind of fills in the empty space of. But if it was realistic, then I think it would have aged much more poorly than it did.
Right, and I think during that time, I believe that like around 2002, between about 2005, the gaming industry was very confused about where it wanted to go, because it was many of these companies were going towards photorealism, right? Mm-hmm. Like they were pushing these 3D graphics. I mean, this was a resurgence of the old Nintendo versus Sega kind of thing, where they were like, hey, you know what? We can do this better than you can do this. But now you had PlayStation. You had like the PlayStation 2, the Xbox, the GameCube. You had those kind of lumped right in there, and they were all pushing like heavy graphics. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, this little game comes out in 2004. This little game comes out, and I can't remember the developer, but Nicholas picked them up, and it was called Cave Story.
Mm.
You remember Cave Story?
Yeah, never played it, but I know its reputation.
Cave Story kind of started this, I like to call it this pixel revolution, you could say, where they were like, you know what, we can make these games look old but feel new, because we'll use a new engine to build them so that they'll be cleaner, they'll move better, and they'll have, we can put more into them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what they did. And so minigames came out later on, years later. You get stuff like Shovel Knight and all the hand-drawn different side scrollers, as well as cell shading and stuff like mm-hmm. that. It all really was hearkening back to the good old days of gaming.
Yeah, that's interesting. So I typically hear it said that sort of call back to those early days was upheld by Nintendo, I think, post GameCube. Definitely when they were sure. like, we're not going to keep up with Sony and Xbox's dedication to realism. So we're just going to do...
And that's apparent with the Wii. Because when the Wii comes out, they were like, well, you guys are going that way. We're going to go way off to the
right. Right. So you had, with the Sony and Microsoft, you had an appeal then to the AAA games that are going to be for the hardcore gamer that are going to push, the graphics and the shooter gameplay and third person adventure and that sort of thing. And then Nintendo's over here like, well, we're just going to make a party system. And the graphics were cartoonish and things mm-hmm. like that. And I think if you view that history of Nintendo and the indie scene kind of working together to be almost like a counter-realism movement, then by the time you get to the Switch, it seems like there's a lot of marriage of indies and Nintendo on the Switch. Now we have, that whole phrase Nindies, the portmanteau.
And I love it. I love it. I mean, I think that it's fantastic that Nintendo has given these little guys, because really they're little guys, mm-hmm. an opportunity to put something that they've really put their blood, sweat, and tears into mm-hmm. onto the Switch. I think it's great.
Some of my favorite games that I've played in the last several years have been indie games that have had that retro aesthetic. And it's not just for that. And I get and I empathize with people who view that as pandering, almost as if I've played a couple indie games where it's like you nailed the retro aesthetic, but it ends there. You don't have any either connection to the past or any new ideas. Mm-hmm. And it's like you just wanted to create a game that would appeal to retro gamers, and that's it.
Well, and those fall apart,
right?
Because it's like putting something that looks like what you're wanting, but it has absolutely no depth whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have. It's not even having the charm of old retro games. It's having, it's having that X factor, you could say, mm-hmm. that is put into it, and really that takes time.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody just throws, somebody can throw together a pixelated game like that.
Yeah,
they can
with today's resources. Oh yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But kind of went on a little bit of a rabbit trail.
No, that's good. So all that to contextualize, Dungeon Fighter Online, interesting as this, that maintains a certain aesthetic, but then it's also an MMO, and I think with it that comes a lot of modern sensibilities. So as we mentioned, they closed the North American servers
in 2013.
Right. Okay. So I played it for about a year, maybe a year and a half tops. I did spend some real money. I was there when they closed it, and they refunded me some of that. So, yeah, because they were like, if you bought something within the past month, we'll refund you. And I was like, okay, I will take that. And I was sad. I remember, there was a part of me, and I shied away about 5 or 6 years later. I shied away from MMOs. Wait, I'm like 5 or 6 years later from 2013. Sounds about right. Okay. Like, I don't want to put myself
in
the future.
No, sure.
But I shied away from MMOs because I got tired of the grind aspect, and I got tired of just the multiplicity of things to do that didn't really seem to drive a story forward or anything like that. As much as I enjoyed, making characters, that was something I loved about MMOs, especially playing DC Universe Online, where I made like a new character like every week just for the sake of having different aesthetics and
You're an altaholic.
Yes.
That's what they call them, altaholics.
Yeah. Yes. It was bad. It was bad. I did run my own league where people could stuff their iconic alts. So,
nice.
And it was a villains league. So if you made, you know, Lex Luthor or the Joker, I had a gentleman ghost character and a Mixius Spitlick character and all these things.
Oh, big, that's cool. See, villains are fun to play.
Yeah. You know, oh, I had a blast. Fun to play. I had a blast with that. But at a certain point, I don't want to do that. I want to play other games, right? And it was taking up all my time. So it was a blessing and a curse that they closed the North American servers, and I never got back into it. So my perspective on this show, listener, is that I played it, you know, at that period of time, at the start of the 2010s, and I've not played it since. But JR's perspective is much more recent then.
Yes, yes. So I did pick it back up. I when it did go down, I actually didn't know.
Oh, so what'd you do? Log in and it was just
gone?
Yeah,
no, I didn't know because I had taken a little bit of hiatus because we were kind of in the middle of moving and everything like that. And so we were getting everything set up and I was like, you know what? I'm going to hop back on DFO. And so I hop back on and it's like, oh, by the way, it's no longer going. So, you know, I rage out on Facebook and everything like that and get all irritated and hot and bothered about it. But the thing is, I found out not long after that they were kind of creating this resurgence. So I hopped back on MapleStory for a little bit because they were still going on. And then they were hinting at MapleStory 2, which I'll get into in a moment. And this DFO ends up coming back in 2015. I decide that, you know, I'm just going to hang out. I'm playing WoW, playing MapleStory. By the way, if you play MMOs, you cannot play a whole bunch of them at the same time.
I can't imagine.
I don't understand people that play multiple MMOs at the same time. Like, I can understand stopping and playing. Like, I had my moment with MapleStory. I had my moment with a little bit of Final Fantasy XIV. It was all right. Mm-hmm. People really love that game. Mm-hmm. Had my moment with EVE Online. If you've never heard about that one, that one's a spaceship game. Mm-hmm. A lot of fun. And then, of course, DFO. But I kind of stopped for a little bit, probably around 2017. I picked it back up and started playing it. All this stuff had happened in the storyline. I mean, there was just a bunch of junk just happened. There was like this giant chaotic, they call it the metastasis, occurred and it switched everything around. People looked different. All the classes looked different. The priest had a haircut. I was like,
the priest had a haircut.
Yeah, he had a haircut. It's like, what happened to my priest? Where's his hair? And I had to start a new one. Because when all that went down, to my knowledge, you really couldn't, you know, you couldn't piggyback on your old character. And so I kind of had to start a new one, and I did. And for me, it's been the priest, but, you know, that's kind of how everything kind of changed. And the story, oh my gosh, the story. The story is actually kind of neat. So the story of Dungeon Fighter Online is based in kind of like this alternate universe where God creates this world called Terra. And Terra is this it's a very beautiful planet, and there's a lot of technology and everything like that. And through technology, they were able to tap into God and gather 12 fragments of him and place them into 12 separate people. These 12 people would become the apostles. That's what they were known as.
Now, I remember that there's a lot of sort of like Judeo-Christian symbolism in
this.
Yes. Was it the Judaic or like the Abrahamic God in this?
No, I mean, I think his name is like Carlos.
Really? Was it?
it's something like that. It's seriously something like that. If I'm remembering correctly, it's like Carlo.
I mean,
or Carlo.
The priest had like crucifix.
Yes.
Like stuff on him.
You could, okay,
Carlos,
see the priest. Yeah, the priest, one of my favorite weapons is the cross. He gets this massive cross that he hangs over his back.
It's like a battle axe.
Beats the crap out of people.
Yeah.
With it. Yeah.
I thought it was super creative.
Beat him up style. I mean, he had these AoEs where he could sweep the cross around and beat him up. But anyway, so he puts these into these apostles, okay? And these apostles, they wage war with one another, and they destroy Terra. Terra just gets obliterated, and the bodies of the apostles get obliterated too, and then their souls fly away. And what is created is kind of a new reality through the destruction of Terra. You have almost like a giant sandwich. So you have, like, on the bottom you have Arid, which is a continent that you start on, by the way. And then above that, I believe it's called Imperium, okay? And then in between it, you have something called the Middle Ocean, all right? And then you have a big tower that kind of connects both of them. Mm-hmm. And then flying in between is a big behemoth, like a giant whale. Mm-hmm. And so that Middle Ocean. And then outside of that, you have something called Pandemonium, which is kind of like the fragments of Terra. And when all of that happened, it created this giant, this radioactive storm that mutated people and turned them into monsters. And the apostles' souls fell onto different beings. And so these apostles are kind of the enemies because they're still trying to take over. They're still trying to take over this new reality. Mm-hmm. And right around the time where they had the shutting down of the servers and the bringing back up of the servers, they kind of justified it by being kind of the apostles destroyed everything.
Wow, so they worked and the shutdown into this.
They kind of worked it out, and it kind of, and then it created something called a metastasis, which created a mirror Arad, all right, like a mirror dimension. And then kind of the people that you're playing are still kind of the same people, but it's a little bit different. It's really, really cryptic and really odd. Like you said, yeah, it has a lot of different Judeo-Christian symbolism. Mm-hmm. I wrote a paper, and one day I'll get it on the website for you, because I think that would be really cool.
Yeah.
If you'll have me.
Well, and real quick on that, I mean, we were doing, before there was a lot of dialing back on, like, just doing so much on the website, we were doing that Magipedia.
Magipedia, yeah, yeah. I loved it.
We were kind of trying to address how there are so many interesting ways that video games incorporate ideas from religion, spiritualism, mythology, folklore, all these realms, and smash them into, you know, one game. And as you're describing this world, I was like, this sounds like your JRPG world. You know,
it is
very much influenced by some Greek ideas and from some Christian ideas, and it is,
and it's all of that kind of thrown together. I mean, even some of the names of the apostles, like Luke and Cain and Balak, which is a transliteration of the Philistine god Baal. I mean, you've got all of these different, things that they throw together, and really that's because Eastern art, okay, there's a defining difference between Western and Eastern, okay? Mm-hmm. Eastern, the religions define their culture. In Western, it's kind of the reverse. It's almost like the culture defines how the religion looks, okay? There's a big difference, and so what they do when you have, like, South Korea, which, by the way, has the largest Christian church in the world, okay, Christianity is big in South Korea. You have people picking and choosing, throwing little tidbits of things into their lore. Mm-hmm. Here, we don't do that in America too much by throwing all that little stuff into our lore, because many people who have strong Christian underpinnings, they think that it's kind of offensive to do that. You know, don't throw the apostles into your fantasy story, because that's kind of offensive. But over there, it's like, you can do that.
And you know what? I actually had some friends over time that I've had interesting discussions with. I don't want to plug myself. I'm not going to say that.
Well, it is your podcast.
It's ridiculous. Let me use a different example.
All right.
Two of my favorite authors, a lot of people's favorite authors, Lewis and Tolkien.
Sure.
And they had differences of opinion on how fiction should incorporate what they considered to be real spiritual truths in their own kind of, you know, cultural definings and things like that. And Tolkien was on this side where you should approach this without really outlying or underlying those things, that they can be present and they can be there. But C.S. Lewis then on the other side is like, well, no, let's have sort of more immediate and in a sense intimate allegory and analogy for these truths. And so they go separate ways in that sense. And I've had friends that have taken, you know, either stance. Some have said regarding stories that I've written that I've shared with privately with friends, and then the one that I've published, that God doesn't belong in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm on the other side. I think that Lewis said it in a sense a little extremely, that fiction, a paraphrase, that fiction is a great way to smuggle in theology. And I don't think that, I think that to me, that's like borderline propaganda, which I'm very much against. But what I am for is that if you have beliefs, if you have ideas, then put them in the thing, put them in the, it's absolutely fiction, put it in the story.
And I'm totally fine with that.
Now,
you know?
within reason, I mean, do it respectively, like, or respectfully rather. Like, so I don't want to depict, I don't want to depict like the beliefs of other people in a way that's demeaning and disrespectful of their free ability to choose to believe in what they want to believe in. But something like, so something like Dungeon Fighter Online, I just think it's interesting. Again, as a Christian myself, I like to say sometimes to avoid all the stigma and connotations and things mm-hmm. like that, I like to say, as a person with some metaphysical beliefs,
that you do have that.
Yes.
So do I.
That's the orator that's mm-hmm. In me who's like, I got to dodge all this. That it's okay. It's fine. It's not something that I personally take offense with. I think that stories are one of the greatest privileges that we have as a race. And one of the best things about being human. So, mm-hmm. I'm all for those stories being as creative as possible. And it's one of the reasons why I love Final Fantasy as well. I mean, there's a great combination of spiritual ideas in Final Fantasy.
There are, and that's probably one of the best examples I can give is, I mean, like Final Fantasy VI, my favorite fight in the entire game, of course, is the Kefka fight. But
yeah,
as you're going through there, you start at the very bottom as you go all the way up to the top through that fight. Everything from the imagery to the music. In fact, as you go through that second phase, that is the nine circles of hell, Dante's Inferno. Mm-hmm. And then you, as you go further up, you can hear kind of the crescendo of the music. It is exactly the same. And Dancing Mad is exactly the same as an overture in Handel's Messiah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Very,
the same.
Very Baroque. You play, you're like, man, this is Italian.
it's true.
No,
it's true.
It's gorgeous. It has that sort of Renaissance-y feeling to it, with all of the figures poised on the Kefka
right.
Tower.
Right. And you wouldn't get that even in DFO. You wouldn't get all of that kind of melting pot if it wasn't for the culture, Eastern culture, where that's a part of their storytelling.
Right.
Their beliefs are a part of their storytelling, and placing that into the narratives that they create.
And it's almost like there's a lack of sterility, I think, with that. You know, I've read a lot of books, man. But
well, you are the well-read mage.
It's R.E.D. I'm just read. I don't claim to
read
too many books, but some of the books that I have read, I just like to say that as a joke to people. But some of the books that I have read, you finish it and you're like, oh, that was just a blank slate. It was sterile.
Yeah, right,
it was
right.
Almost like they held themselves back, or they put on kid gloves because they didn't want to, say this or that. Yeah,
at the very
it's like,
end. Yeah.
I mean, just tell a good story. That's all. Mm-hmm. Anyway, all that to say, tell a good story.
So yeah, that's basically the story of DFO, and I mean, it's still like any MMO. Because I look at World of Warcraft, my goodness, I feel sorry for the people in World of Warcraft. I feel sorry for the people in Azeroth, because there they are. They're just hanging out. They're doing their own thing. All this wonderful stuff's happening. All of a sudden, oh, great, there's a Lich King. Okay, well, we got to kill this guy. So they kill him, and it's like, oh, great, he's dead. And then all of a sudden, oh, there's this giant dragon we forgot. He opens up the earth, destroys everything in this giant cataclysm. Well, that's all right. Okay, we'll beat him. Oh, all of a sudden, there's this new island that appears down south. Let's go check it out. It's full of panda people. Oh, that's really cool. Oh, what happens? Oh, there's an old god that is rising up to kill everybody. Oh, okay, that's great. And then there's a war, and then they go back in time. And then it's like with every new expansion that any MMO does, they're going to be throwing in new cataclysmic events to keep things interesting. That's one thing about MMOs I don't like, is that there really is no closure.
Yeah, it's just the never-ending story. It's almost episodic in that sense. And I empathize with that, too. I've gotten back into reading comic books recently.
Yeah.
And I've been posting a lot about that. And I enjoy it. I love it. One thing that I gravitate towards specifically in comic books is the graphic novel with a start and a finish.
It can be a conclusion, yes.
Right. And it can be part of a character who has been published. I mean, like I was talking with another mage recently. Some of these characters, I mean, you're going to be looking at 100 years worth of publishing history pretty soon, which is baffling.
Easily.
That's a humongous length of time to consistently publish new stories for a character. But with that comes the necessity that there's no closure, because then there can be there for the next generation. But within that, it's nice that you do have those graphic novels, like, you know, like The Killing Joke is a favorite story, or All-Star Superman, where there's a start and a finish. With right. MMOs, I totally get what you're saying. The most recent MMO I attempted was Final Fantasy 14, which I actually loved.
Yeah, it's a great game. Good everything, really.
And as a Final Fantasy fan, it's nice to see all the throwbacks and things like that. A lot of people were like, you know, the writing's really good and the story's really good. And I'm like, I played it for hours. When does the story start? But in a sense, I think that with an MMO, the experience is the story. You're almost building it as you're going through, whereas the expansion is the premise. They're just like, hey, in an episodic sense, there's a new Dark Lord, and how you go about, you know, building friendships and a community and a guild or what have you, is that story of overcoming the Dark Lord.
Yeah, yeah. And so MMOs have a very endearing place with a lot of people, because what it does, what they do, is they incorporate you into the story. And that was kind of something that you had mentioned in one of your tweets, was about agency. With can you really get player agency? I mean, you know, I think agency, which basically means, can a player actually make a difference in the game, or is it just pigeonholed into doing what the game wants you to do, right? With MMOs, it gives you some agency. You know, like, you're able to make your own professions, you're able to do things like that. I mean, DFO does that. DFO allows for you to have the agency. If you want to spend real money on that really sweet skin, go ahead, man. It's perfectly fine. You know, are you going to look the same as everybody else? Probably. But you get to do what you want to do. And in the case of other games, not so much.
Yeah. So that it is an interesting question, and that was a question that you brought up earlier. Is true agency possible? I'm not a developer. I don't have, you know, connections with developers in like a personal sense, except for those that I've written alongside of and interacted with online. And so when I think of agency, I think about, you know, a multiplicity of player choice. And I was wondering, regarding your question, do you think that emergent gameplay is a potential answer to the question of, is there true, or can there be true agency?
Oh, no, you have to pontificate on that one.
Sure. I will pontificate. That's a great word.
Pontificate, please.
So emergent gameplay is, did you play Breath of the Wild?
I did.
Oh,
I did.
Okay. So that's one that pops in my head all the
time. Okay.
So
yeah,
you
I get
know,
you.
You see clips all the time of people creating like a hovercraft or friggin' like launching a tree by like freezing it or hitting a boulder and then launching themselves into the stratosphere. So emergent gameplay is anything that sort of players themselves create that wasn't explicitly designed by the game's creators. So it's almost like when people create like a meta narrative or a game on top of the game. It's like you could even take advantage of glitches and broken things and bugs and make your own game out of those. So like you could have and I saw this, people actually did this with Breath of the Wild, is a race across the map from north to south. And they could, you could launch yourself on stones and things like that. But that's not the game.
Yeah.
But it is a game.
So I'm gonna answer that question by weaving it back into DFO here.
Good. That's good.
as kind of the idea of agency. MMOs do employ agency. Okay. Now that I'm thinking about it, but they employ it through a little bit different means. Some people are into it, some people are not, and that is role-playing.
Mm.
Okay? Role-playing is a huge, huge thing with many MMOs, to where a person basically takes on the identity of their avatar.
Mm-hmm.
And so they talk like them through text. They create their own little relationships and own little tiffs and, you know, hey, let's go take out this person or something like that. Like in DFO, it's a large enough game to where you can, if all your people are high enough levels, you can go around and you can have different role-playing little exercises that you create that are not necessarily tied into the mechanics of the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, well, there was this goblin in this one dungeon that I've got to go take out, because Dungeon Fighter is basically when you log on, you get to choose your character, you know, what your class is and everything like that, and then you get into the game and you go through a little tutorial, and then it immediately gets you into the beat 'em up action of that game, which I believe is the core gameplay. And then there are little instances are basically separate areas of the game. Some of them are very RNG, which is random number generated. So it can be anything could be in these dungeons. And so people play with that. Like they say, well, you know what? We're going to go kill this one goblin. We're going to find this special thing that he stole from me. And so you go into a dungeon and he's not there. Or you go into another dungeon and he's not there. It would be like a rare mob like you would find in Diablo.
Mm.
You know? And people have been playing like this for years, and it keeps the game fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Many people, like my wife, is like, well, that's a little nerdy. Well, you know what? Yeah, it is. But you know what? It's still fun.
Yeah.
It's still fun.
And fun being this elusive, subjective experience that
it is. Yeah, of course. It's,
I mean,
completely
but
subjective.
The point is, it's fun to the people to whom it's fun, right?
Exactly. Yeah. It's fun. It's fun to people who enjoy the idea of really putting yourself into a character.
Yes. Now, let me ask you, how do you feel about RPing?
I don't do it. I don't personally do it.
Uh-huh.
I feel a little weird.
It's almost like there's a very conscious suspension of disbelief that needs to occur, right?
Yeah, like you kind of have to tear that veil between what you know is reality and what you keep lying to yourself.
Mm.
You know, like it's like you know, we had a place right down the road from where I live that they're kind of a they play the Dungeons and Dragons and everything like that, and boy, they RP hardcore. Like they dress up and all that stuff.
Oh wow, yeah.
And my son was like, we were walking by, I think it was like, it had to have been like last August or something. We were walking by and he looks over and he's like, oh, look, they're putting on a play.
They are.
Like,
Technically,
but exactly what that is.
Yeah, but just not in the stage sense.
No.
Yeah. So I did a little bit of RPing in DC Universe, because sure. It lended itself towards it if we're playing as these famous characters, General Zod or you know, what have you. At a certain point, so I ran into people who that's all they wanted to do. And I told a lot of stories about that on the DC Universe episode. If you're listening, you're like, I want to hear the juicy tidbits of like the guy who like flipped out and started like getting really crazy with it. I mean, he had a Joker character and he would gravitate to all of these Harley Quinn characters. Many of which were played by women, and it did not go well. So, ooh. Yeah. So there's a lot of things that happened with that. I'm not coloring all role players like that. But there are some people that take it very seriously.
So, I mean, along with that, I mean, there are a lot of different, you know, characters that you can build in this game that will allow for you to be who you want to be in DFO. And I like that part of it, like the classes and everything like that.
Yeah, I think that's one of the big draws of, for me at least, for an MMORPG, is what are some of the characters and classes that are available? That's always interesting.
Well, with this game, okay, so I guess I could jump into that.
Yes, let's do it.
So you've got the 16, all right? And the 16 are... I'll go through them again, and really, I'll just say slayers, male, female, fighters, male, female, gunners, male, female, mages, male, female, priest, male, female, then a thief, a knight, demonic, lancer, an agent, a creator, and a dark knight. Okay, so to break all of this down real quick, when the game first came out, it only had, I want to say, six classes. It had a male slayer, a female fighter, a male gunner, a female mage, a male priest, and a thief.
That sounds right, because I don't remember. Oh no! So they'd actually just rolled out male mage roundabout.
Oh, they
when
did
I
reel.
Stopped.
Yeah, that was one of the first ones that they rolled out.
Yeah, and I don't remember creator, dark knight, agent at all.
Yeah, so those are somewhat new. I mean, they're not as new as like demonic lancer and agent, but so basically. With the classes, what makes them really unique is their play style. So it's a beat 'em up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it's a side scroller beat 'em up. You've got horizontal gameplay, then you've got vertical, okay? Kind of like going up and down, across, everything like that. So with the... let me use the one that I know, because my main character was a priest,
mm-hmm.
was a male priest, and he would later become an exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they are really, really good with AoEs, which is area of effect moves, and they're also really good with healing, and they do have some synergy moves, which synergy is like buffs and debuffs.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You would put on an enemy, or you would put on a character to kind of get them stronger. As you're moving along in the game, you can, there's like a talent tree that's really, really complex.
Yes.
Where you've seen talent trees before, and this one has got a sprawling talent tree where you can choose what to have, what not to have. There are, I believe, five different sets of armor: cloth, leather, light, heavy, and plate armor. And then there's accessories, special equipment you can use. You can even put little creatures that will accompany you and everything like that. Each specific class is able to hold a different weapon. All right. So like the fighters, they can get claws or knuckles. The priests, of course, they talk about the cross. They can also hit people with a giant rosary.
Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah.
I was cracking up.
Yeah, seriously. And it's still part of the game. And then you've got, let me think. The gunners are fun, man.
Yeah, I thought they were
great. The gunners are just so cool. Because the male gunner, he's like this lanky Depeche Mode looking guy that just you can shoot people from all pretty good distance mm-hmm. with a gun. And they actually have, this is the male and the female gunners, to my memory, they're like the same, really. That's the only one class I could say that's very similar to each other. Mm-hmm. I like the male launcher because he gets like a rail cannon or something like that.
Yeah. And
it's really neat that this game kind of molds like old school, you know, like Knights of the Round type stuff, and then employs kind of the almost like a, I would almost say like 2D shooter feel,
right,
to some of it. It's really neat.
Yeah, it is a great combination. One thing that I wanted to raise, so you mentioned launcher just now, and mm-hmm. that's not one of the base classes that we mentioned.
It's not a base class.
Right. So what you have is these base classes that can then be upgraded or changed to a variety of other subclasses. So like right now I'm looking at female slayers can be a swordmaster, a dark templar, a demon slayer, or a vagabond. Apparently,
and I'm not too familiar with those ones. Okay. Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, I mean, you look at the male slayer; he can be a blade master. Mm-hmm. Female can be a sword master. Those are two different, like, specializations. Mm-hmm. They fight differently.
Right.
They do different things. They may be similar on the, you know, they may be similar, but they're different. I like that ability to be able to completely customize your character with its combat maneuvers and everything like that. Because like a beat 'em up, you can do kind of these combos. But unlike a beat 'em up, there's hotkeys. You know what a hotkey is? Mm-hmm. Like one through, well, plus. And you could basically, you play this on a keyboard. And you use the hotkeys to do special maneuvers and moves. And as you go towards the end game, which it's a little bit different. It goes from being a beat-em-up to being more of an action RPG like Diablo. Mm-hmm. And that was something that one of the guys had mentioned on Twitter.
Right. That was that. Bacon Apocalypse.
Bacon Apocalype.
He said, yeah, for sure, DFO has the core side-scrolling beat-em-up feel when leveling. Sadly, leveling is brain-dead easy and has zero reflection on the end game. This happened because, like a lot of older MMOs, they dumbed down and sped up the leveling to get players to the expanding end game. After the Power Fantasy extended tutorial leveling phase ends, it's when more of the MMO things start to kick in. With party composition and classes,
yes,
preform their DPS, synergy, holder, and support roles become very important. The game, as you said, becomes much more of an action RPG, like a 2D Diablo.
And he's absolutely right. The only thing that we really disagree with on, because he harps on the progression to end game, mm-hmm. and I'm going to tell you right now. And this is me right here. I do not like the end game. I do not like it in a house. I do not like it with a mouse. I do not like it here or there. I do not like it anywhere. I do not like the end game of DFO. Other games, yes, it's manageable, but this one, I do not like it.
Yeah, and so without having reached the end game myself at all, I don't think I reached it back in the day. I don't know if I'll ever reach it, but I think I get kind of why. I reached end games in other MMOs, and then I was like, why am I still playing this?
Well, it's different with this MMO because you need to understand something about the DFO fan base. And gosh, I don't want to, I'm not making fun of anybody. I'm not, but the fan base is a little more caustic. That's a good word.
That is a good word.
A little bit more caustic than other fan bases because, the people who have been playing it for many years, they get very enveloped into this game and they can get a little rough on you if your DPS, which is damage per second, is a little low. Mm-hmm. That's the one thing about playing MMOs that a lot of people don't like, is that you have to play with other people.
Right. It's in the in the genre title.
It's massive multiplayer, and so you have to deal with people when you're playing as a pug, which basically means you're jumping in on an open group that you don't know any of the people that you're playing with.
Right, and if you don't know what you're doing, they'll let you know.
Oh,
yeah. I've had that experience, yeah.
It really pulls people away from the game, and with DFO, their end game is very... It can be like that. Another thing about DFO that I do not like, oh my gosh, the numbers. They are incredible. The numbers. So, like, hit points. When you say, like, the standard hit point range for a Final Fantasy game is 9,999 hit points, right?
Yeah, as maximum, yeah. Yeah,
so this game is, like, in the trillions. And I'm talking like average right now that people are pulling on in this game is like 250 billion hit points.
Wow.
And this is in game. They now have a level 100 cap. So, and are they going to go further if they keep making money? Yes, they will. And the thing is, when you get that high in the numbers, a lot of MMOs, World of Warcraft is one of them, do something called stats compression, where they bring the stats back down in numbers, but they don't change the functionality of the characters. But they don't do that in this game. They let you nail somebody for 180 trillion hit points, and the numbers just stack across. There's some guys like the Agent. The Agent is just awesome with these hits, because he'll do multiple hits. And there are some times where you would hit a person with an Agent and all you would see in the entire screen is numbers.
Wow.
That's it.
That's crazy. And that's like already, to somebody like me who does not play, especially browser-based MMOs, too frequently, those numbers are intimidating. When I see a screen crowded with people, it's where you can't even see the ground and it's just numbers and names, I'm like, I don't even know what to do. I like get paralyzed.
And so that's kind of what a lot of people are like, please, Neopal, just bring the numbers down a little bit. Please do stat compression. But they want their players to feel powerful. And boy, they're powerful, all right. I mean, when you're hitting somebody for, you know, 999 trillion, 999 billion, 999 million, 999,999 hit points, then you're pretty powerful.
Yeah. And to me, that kind of seems like the tone that they set for DFO, as far as like the trailers and the visuals, mm-hmm. that very much almost like a punk kind of rock sort of scene where all these characters have all these dramatic. I'm approaching it from a graphic design perspective all these edges and spikes and they look angry and furious and vicious. And a part of that probably appeals to that, having that many numbers and just being like, it's so over the top, you know?
It is. And the game is over the top. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's also a really big appeal for it, is the game is just, it's a lot of fun. And it's free, like 100% free. And if you wanted to, you could get to level 100 without paying a cent. But it's going to take a long time because of those fatigue points, mm-hmm. you know, that I was talking about.
Right.
And so, and you can get contracts and different things like that, but you have to buy. There's three different kinds of currency in this game. There's gold, which is the standard currency that you can use, okay, that you get from monsters. Then there's mileage, which you get from moving through dungeons and progression. And then there is finally Serra. Or CERA, which you use to, well, with real money, really, to purchase these things and to get to end game. Mm. And you do that through buying contracts to different dungeons, instances, things like that. And if you are really invested in this, you're going to be spending a lot of money on it.
Yeah. Can confirm. So what were some of your before we leave the classes discussion, what were some of your favorite classes, maybe like a top three classes?
Top three. Loves Priest. Exorcist is fantastic. The Male Fighter Striker is great. Male Fighter Striker is just awesome. I mean, just rapid fire hits. And that's really, that brings me back to the idea of the beat 'em up,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I love the regular game progression. I don't like in game, but I love the regular game progression because the grind, because it's just beat 'em up. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
And you go in with four players in a dungeon. It feels like an old school couch co-op beat 'em up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's great. And then I really enjoyed the Male Launcher. Definitely.
That was when I don't think I ever got to play.
Yeah, the Male Gunner or Male Launcher, yeah.
For me...
What about you? Yeah, what did you like?
I played Thief as my main.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still in the game, right? It's like a dark elfish kind of looking character.
Yeah. You can be a necromancer, basically, or a shadow dancer.
Yeah. I think there was Rogue at the time.
There was Rogue, yeah.
Is that still around?
It's still there. Yeah.
Okay. So that was one that I gravitated toward because I liked the speed. And then I liked this sort of personal challenge that I set for myself of, like, don't touch the ground. So you could do a lot of, like, aerial combos with that character and juggle enemies and... that was just fun.
That's fun.
Yeah.
That is fun.
That's a lot of fun. And then I also liked playing as the summoner. That's a female mage.
Mm-hmm.
Summoner was a subclass. You just, you know, fill up the screen with a bunch of mooks and that's always fun.
Those ones are really good for PvP.
I bet. Because you just get swamped,
yeah.
huh?
Yeah.
And then looking at the list...
You tell me you had to have tried a priest.
You know, I did. There was a lot of one. I mean, I'm sure I tried all of them that were available at the time, and mm-hmm. like female gunner and priest, male priest stood out to me a lot. I think I did. Male priest might have been my very first character, but I don't recall how far I got with that character. Furthest I ever got was with the thief. But who knows how far that even was at this point. So where do you see this franchise going? I mean, we've kind of talked a little bit about, you know, whether they'll raise the roof on the level cap and things like that. There's a statement here from T. Bellow. Mm-hmm. No, let's say it again. From T. Bellow, 23 on Twitter, who said, "I used to love DFO. Would be awesome if it came to PS5. Do you think that they'll ever do a home console version of DFO?
I don't know. So we'll kind of bring this all to a head here because DFO is, of course, a very regional title, right? I mean, it's mm-hmm. kind of it's kind of got this whole regional thing going on with South Korea. And so they have a very large following over there. And as any of the games that come from the studio, they're usually released, a few years prior until they hit America
mm-hmm.
or Europe. You know, they hit the global stage. They're usually in China, Japan, or South Korea first. Okay? And I'm going to kind of run on a little rabbit trail just because I wanted to cover this. It's like with Maple Story. You know, Maple Story is held really, really strong, but it's not... I don't think it's ever going to hit console. It's kind of fastened into being a PC game.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago... they came out with Maple Story 2. I started playing that game. Really had a good time on PC. I really, really liked it. And then all of a sudden, they stripped, this last May, they stripped it from North America.
Hmm.
And a lot of that had to do with, the term is regional lockout. Because, and there's three reasons that this happens, by the way. It is economic... economy, distribution, and culture.
Hmm.
And I want to say that it had a lot to do with economy because it just wasn't really making headway over here. And so they pulled it. for DFO, it's still doing all right over here in America. Mm-hmm. And I know that for the future of this franchise, they have something online, you can look it up. It's called Project BBQ. Project Barbecue, of all things. And it is a 3D dungeon fighter online. And it looks amazing.
And this is something that they're working on?
They're working on it, yeah.
Is there a release date for it that you know?
No. Okay. The Project BBQ, what was it? I think it was 2008, maybe the end of 2008. It came out as a trailer, mm-hmm. and they shows, like I said, you can look it up on YouTube. It shows a Slayer, a 3D Slayer, and then I think a Blade Master, just or a knight tearing the tar out of these monsters in the kind of the 3D thing, and it really looked like Devil May Cry mixed with a little bit of Monster Hunter.
Yeah, looking at it now, it reminds me a lot of Xenoblade Chronicles 2.
Yeah,
actually,
yeah,
it has that kind of anime.
But it has that anime feel, but it is an action RPG. Yeah. Like it's one of those things where you don't have to click and then hit person as you're waiting. You know, kind of the point and click hits like World of Warcraft. This is a real 3D action RPG, and it looks awesome. And so they don't have a release date on it. It's still over there. It may very well, when they release it, it'll probably be released regionally, mm-hmm. because South Korea is really, really big on doing that. They're really big on releasing things regionally first, waiting a little bit, and then porting it back over into a global stage. And I really think the big reason for that is because I don't think they have a whole lot of distribution studios around the world. Nexon, I don't think they have a whole bunch, or Neopal doesn't have a whole bunch. And so you can imagine how much money it would cost,
right,
in order to distribute things like that. One of the reasons that old games weren't distributed over here is because one of the major costs was English translation.
Right. Exactly. And that is a good point to raise. I was talking with somebody fairly recently, and you know, we both kind of came to the realization that there's a lot of people that just want games to pop into existence as if magic, you know, were real. That you could just, oh yeah, sure, we'll just, you know, we'll translate every single foreign language game ever, and we'll just distribute them here, and it'll be on all platforms. That's like, but... I always hate to be that guy who's like, but from a business perspective, you just can't do that.
Okay. I'm going to say something very important for all of our listeners. America is not the center of the gaming world.
Or even the center of the world, never mind gaming. But
let me hit you with a few statistics. Okay? And I'm actually going to put on my styrofoam hat here.
You have a styrofoam hat at the ready. Wow.
Yeah. There we go. It's on. Okay. So I'm going to put on my styrofoam hat. 36% of the world's population is in China and India. Mm-hmm. 36%. 60% of the world's population is in Asia. 40% everywhere else, because that makes 100%. That's math. Mm-hmm. And so you look at it like that. How much percentage of the world's population is in America? You know, off the top
no,
of your head?
No, I don't know off the top of my head, no.
4.5.
Yeah, it's tiny.
Yeah, compared to those other countries, it is.
Yeah, and
you know,
I want to raise with that too, something that we talked about on Story Mode podcast several weeks ago, was all of these numbers and percentages and statistics that have come out showing that the North American market is last in terms of how the percentage of gamers present and how much money is being spent. And it's interesting because online, you know, we're only pretty much talking with, and this is a point I've made before, so we're only talking with sort of the hardcore crowd, because we are people who have online accounts where we talk about games, which is not I don't want to say normal, but it's not the average. Let's put it that way. We are hobbyists that are speaking with other hobbyists, whereas we're not the people who are going out and purchasing, you know, like I want to say the same FIFA game every year or something like that. But those games sell, right?
Well, they sell really well.
Right, yeah. Really well. But good luck finding anybody who doesn't think that those are utter trash online, because the people that we're talking to online are not the main demographic.
No, they are not. That's one of the reasons.
Yes.
And that's why it's so cool that you decided to kind of showcase this game, is because this shows a really great truth about the gaming industry, is that some of the largest games that are out there are nowhere to be seen in America. Mm-hmm. Because America is only a small portion of the market. It's only a small portion of the market. If you want to look at what's really trending, what's really going on, what's really going to probably hit the future of gaming, go over to Asia, go over to Beijing, go over to Seoul, go over to Tokyo, take a look around and see what they're doing. I mean, anime has already gotten incredibly popular over here in America. And I think a lot of that reason is because there is an Eastern shift, all right, when it comes to art and it comes to different things like that. There's an Eastern shift that is kind of, people in the West are very, we love this stuff, mm-hmm. man. We really, really do.
Yeah. You sort of, you know, in the past several years, you sort of, like, so I remember when I was a kid in school. And growing up in Hawaii, I had a lot of Japanese friends and got to watch a lot of anime. But those were still very much niche things. And every time we would sit down and watch, you know, a DVD that my friend had, because he was Japanese and he could speak it and all that stuff, then I always got the gist of, like, this is something that's not from here. This is special. This is unique. This is not, you know, your Saturday morning cartoon. Over time, it seems like we've seen this movement towards, I don't know if people still say Japanophile. I haven't heard that in years, but,
I would have a hard time with it.
No,
throwing that one out there.
I haven't heard that in years, but I remember that when that kind of was rolling out, and it sounds a little derogatory. So I think that's why they kind of
ever so slightly.
That. Yeah. but then we moved to Weeaboo and Weebs. And there's still an element of the derogatory with that. Like, oh, you're just a Weeaboo.
Ever so slightly. Yeah. That was one of the ideas that I had for the title for this
show. Oh, for this show.
Weebs got a game for you.
Oh, that's funny. And I think, too, that there's a fascination, which to me is fascinating. I'm not, you know, I've gone on record saying I don't care for anime too much, but I do like specific anime. And mm-hmm. same thing with manga. Used to consume a lot of it. Maybe I consumed too much of it and burned out on it. I don't know. But my point is that there are a lot of people in other countries who are very interested in, you know, to capitalize on what you were saying, very interested in, you know, Japanese culture and emulating that and learning the language and that sort of thing. So there is definitely a sort of cultural shift towards being aware of those things that has happened in the past 30 years.
And what's cool is we now live in a world where you can't access that.
Right.
You know, you can't access that. And legally.
Right.
You know, I mean, you can go online, you can find that old cryptic game that was never released, and you can check it out. You know, I mean, that's kind of the way that a lot of this, I like it. I really do, because it's kind of like when I was looking at Nintendo Power back in the day, and they were hinting about all these games that were going to be coming out. Like Bahamut Lagoon is the one that I always talk about, and that was a regional title.
Mm-hmm.
That came out the same year, I want to say it came out the same year as Final Fantasy VI, maybe Chrono Trigger, I'm not sure. But it came out around that time, and so you had some pretty big titles that were coming out, and basically it's all about economy,
mm-hmm.
And distribution. They looked at it and they're like, we're not going to worry about that one right now.
Mm-hmm. Which to us, you know, may seem unfair. And I've met a lot of people who are, they've got some anger about that. But, but again, it's the realistic thing. It's like when I talk to people about, the classic mini consoles, and they'll be like, why didn't they just put the whole Super Nintendo library on it? And I was like, because they can't. From a business perspective, they just can't. There's licensing, there's ownership, there's all kinds of really mundane and boring answers that are the reason why you can't have just magic.
Many mundane games. And boring answers that will cost you millions.
Right, exactly. As consumers, we don't care. Like, you know, I don't care about licensing. I don't care about like the cost of localization. I just want the game. But sure. That's a realistic answer as to why we didn't get Bahamut Lagoon.
Mm-hmm. So as far as DFO is concerned, it's a great game that, it's a really good game that is free to play. Anybody can play it right now. I mean, you could just hop right off of this Magecast right now, go right over to DFO, and check it out yourself.
Yes.
It's really cool. And one of the things I recommend is to download the client directly off of the site, because the Steam client will work, but it's a little janky. You know, it doesn't go through all the time. And so I just download the client directly off the site and do it that way.
Good to know. Well, we'll have a link to that in the podcast description. As we near kind of the end of this, a couple of things that some folks said. VGM on Twitter said, at the time it came out, like many Korean MMOs of that time, it was refreshing and different from the army of WoW clones we had. I'm happy it survived all these years, even if there was rough times.
I like that.
Yeah, I like that too. It does highlight that I think that this is a very different kind of MMO. And I ran into people who had impressions of, you know, Korean MMOs are kind of like this. But it was refreshing for me because, you know, I'd only played certain kinds of games, and this was a nice combination of ideas with its genres and things like that.
That's cool. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. And that really is, that's very true, because there were WoW clones. That was, and really actually they're EverQuest clones, if we're to be honest here.
Yes.
WoW is an EverQuest clone.
EverQuest has been around for so long. I remember being in grade school and we would smash I had a classmate who was so into EverQuest, and he used to call it Evercrack. And it was just addicting.
Let's say World of Warcraft.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
You could add that word pretty much to anything.
Yeah, pretty much.
any MMO.
I've never played it, but it has a reputation, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
So a couple final questions here, actually from just one dude. But if you want to have us answer your question on this show, you'll want to keep an eye on my Twitter at the Well-Read Mage. There I announce the topics for each Magecast episode in advance, let you know about the game that we're going to talk about. And you can email me if you prefer, if you're like, I don't do Twitter. Well, you can email me at thewellreadmage@gmail.com. I'm kind of on the fence of if I should reveal the next game now or not. Maybe I will.
That's up to you.
Yeah, I know. I hate it when it's up to me, because then it's like, well, what do you think I should do?
I don't even know what the game is. I mean, it would be a surprise to me.
Yeah. Okay.
I just found out.
Okay. I think, you know what? I'm gonna start announcing the next game, on the show. That way, maybe people listening to this, I don't know, because I think more people listen to this than see a tweet. So maybe we'll do that.
Okay, yeah.
That kind of makes sense. So the next game that I'm going to be talking about on the next episode of Magecast is Vagrant Story. So looking to have quite a good discussion with that. A returning guest, who I won't reveal yet. We'll keep that a secret. But hopefully, if everything works out, that'll be the next game we talk about. But for DFO, this is from Aros Elric. Ever faithful Aros Elric, who always asks a question. I love it. He said, what are your thoughts on MMOs versus local couch co-ops from the 90s? Do you believe it's more a difference in taste between Japanese and American gamers? So we kind of talked.
Question. I get this question now. Now that you read it to me,
Good. Now I want to mention that I had to ask for some clarification. I think it's a really interesting question, but a very specific question, and so I wanted to be sure what he meant when he asked it. So, what's your takeaway here?
The way I take it is, I mean, what's the main difference here between, you know, playing online, you know, like we're playing online, you know, and couch co-op games, mm-hmm. okay? Because you got like the MMO, like for example, okay, so I'm playing a beat 'em up, MMO beat 'em up, DFO. Online, okay, and there's couch co-op, MMO. I mean, what's the main take here? Honestly, I think I like to play couch co-op a lot more than I like playing MMO games.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really do online games because I feel like I can get closer to the people that I'm actually playing with. I am a big person with my own podcast, which is the Kith and Kin Gaming Podcast. I'm a really big advocate of families playing together,
mm-hmm.
and so yeah in face-to-face, because personal gatherings are really important. So that's how I kind of interpret that, is that those games were really simple. They're not as involved as MMOs, but they're more fun because you could really, in my opinion, they're more fun because you could really invest with somebody right next to you.
Mm-hmm. I would want to echo that, and I agree with you in terms of my preference, that I would rather play a local couch co-op than an MMO. I don't know the people for the most part. I mean, I've played MMOs with friends. But the majority of the people that I'm going to be playing with are complete strangers. Sometimes they're crazy. Sometimes you end up making new friends, which I did previously. And that's nice. You know, you keep track of each other through social media and you share ideas and things like that. And eventually you go your separate ways. Fine. But it's fun to make new friends. But I think that there is something so special about the human presence when you're playing with somebody right next to you. And to even kind of stretch this idea out further, it's still different, couch co-op, from playing online co-op with your friends and family. Because you're still disconnected. You're not right there. You can't high-five a screen.
No.
Some of my favorite memories then have been with couch co-op. And I get, you know, you take what you can get. Playing games with family across long distance is still fun in its own way. That's just my preference. The way that I took this question was, is there kind of some analogy between Japanese and American culture and MMOs and local couch co-ops, specifically said from the 90s? And so I was kind of thinking, I mean, a lot of games in the 90s were Japanese anyway. Thinking about the big beat 'em up type games that were popular at the time. And we kind of, I think we kind of tend to look back and be like, well, that was an American experience, the arcades and things like that. But it was not an exclusively American experience. But the second part of his question here, a simpler one to answer. What are your favorite beat-em-up characters to play as? Keep in mind X-Men's Colossus special is off the table.
I'm kind of a Hagger kind of guy. You know, I like to play the big boys. You know, I do.
Well, that,
you know,
explains like the
Hagger,
priest,
Maximus,
then.
Those big guys.
So my gamer confession is I tend to like to play as female characters.
Okay.
I've mentioned that on this show before, that they're faster. And to me, that's more enjoyable than just kind of lumbering around. I played a brilliant, I thought it was brilliant, a brilliant indie beat-em-up recently.
What was it called?
Shoot, give me a second. I can't even remember the title. It was called Fight and Rage. Did you hear that?
Oh, yes.
Did you play it?
I have heard. I have not played it yet.
Okay.
But I've heard such good things.
Gameplay-wise, absolutely brilliant. Really fun. Big emphasis on combos. One of the really great things about it is there's branching paths. Some of them are secret. Some of them are more obvious than others. Cool. Depending on characters you choose, the number of characters that are playing, because it's couch co-op. A lot of people have mentioned they really wish that they would include online co-op, which that could be very cool. But I thought it had so much character. There's a shop where you could buy different skins and characters and all kinds of things.
I'll have to check it out. Yeah. I've heard of it.
Yeah, definitely a cool one. So, and that one was made by a guy from, I believe it was Brazil.
Cool.
But don't quote me on that. So anyway, that was a great one. And there's a lot of great beat-em-ups out there. But favorite beat-em-up characters to play as, I would probably just say the more agile characters.
The more agile characters,
rather than the more lumbering characters. So in that's what reminded me. In that particular game, there's three characters. There's a female fighter, a ninja, a male ninja, and a male minotaur.
It'd probably be the Minotaur.
Yeah, a great team then, because I'd be either. And this is how brilliant this game is. There were the character names. I can't remember the name of the Minotaur. The female fighter's name is Gal. The male ninja's name is F. Norris. I couldn't stop laughing. I was like, "That's great." I don't know who came up with that, but 10 out of 10. Speaking of 10 out of 10, this was a great conversation. Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
It was. I really, really enjoyed it. And as I tell everybody, check out DFO for yourself. I mean, if you like beat-em-up games, you'll love it. If you love RPGs, you'll enjoy it. If you like free games, which I don't know many people who don't, you'll also like it.
Yeah, and I'm a little scared to admit it, but I might want to start picking this up back again. So I was looking at the website right now, and there's a download button. I'm like, should I?
There you go. Right now.
I could. I just don't want to. I think I'm hopefully going to be able to uphold the oath that I swore at one point in my life to never spend money in an MMO on cosmetics ever again, but we'll see how far that goes.
We'll see. They're pretty good at getting it on.
Oh, they are, because once you see that dude that's covered in like red glowing spike monsters with the flaming eyes, I'm like, I want that.
Oh yeah, I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like,
it's
what?
Not like you made that up, right?
And it's just like, yeah, end level characters just parading themselves before the peasants. You're like, I want to be that cool.
Oh, but that's so fun to do.
It is. But then I don't want to spend the money on it. Well, anyway, where can our listeners find you, JR?
You can find me on Twitter. I'm on Twitter, and I am JR Sommerfeldt, or just Sommerfeldt R, underscore R. And you could also find me on Twitch, and JR Sommerfeldt at Twitch. You just look me up there. I'm trying to think of my exact URL. And then I also have a podcast called the Kith and Kin Gaming Podcast that is on from Buzzsprout. And that is anywhere you get your podcasts, you can find that one. So it's called the Kith and Kin Gaming Podcast.
Beautiful. All right. Well, thanks so much for being on the show and talking about DFO. I really liked that we kind of got into some areas that I wasn't anticipating, and it was wonderful. It was a good conversation.
It really was, and definitely love to do it again sometime.
Yes, we will have to have you back. Well, as they say in DFO, have a good night. Thank you so much for listening. MageCast Podcast was made possible by our supporters at patreon.com/thewellreadmage. If you'd like to support the show and help us cover all our bases, check out our crowdfunding campaign, link in the description. You can also shoot over to Twitter and find me at TheWellReadMage or join our Discord community, link also in the description. As for this episode, well, it may be over, but the legend will live on. Passed down by the dwarves,
the elves, and the dragons.
Okay, so look, you've been thinking to yourself for a while now about launching a podcast. I mean, I've met a lot of people who have talked about starting their own show. The difference between you and them could be that you're actually going to do it. You're actually going to create something, contribute, share your message, reach an audience, and just let your voice be heard. There's never been a better time to create a podcast than now. But there's tons of research to do, and hosts, and catchers, and resources to sort through, and honestly, it can feel overwhelming. I should know, I've helped launch a handful of pods myself in the past few years. But the most essential component that I've found for the shows I'm a part of has been Buzzsprout. Buzzsprout is the host I use for Magecast. It's the host of Story Mode, Philosophy Raga, SideQuests, but it's also so much more than just a host. They have powerful analytics, an expanding directory of apps, monetization features, helpful guides, embed tools, and a custom URL for each show that's really helped our podcast out. Sure, it is a highly saturated arena of content, podcasting, but I believe you get what you put into it, and Buzzsprout has been a key ingredient. Podcasting should be easy as having a conversation. And Buzzsprout takes a lot of the pain out of finding an audience, uploading to catchers, and delivering consistent, quality content. It's time now to quit daydreaming about that podcast you've always wanted to do and just start. You can always upgrade your gear later. You can always upgrade to a bigger plan later if you need the space. Check out the link in this episode's description to sign up for Buzzsprout and let them know that we sent you. If you sign up for a paid plan, you can net a $20 Amazon gift card as a bonus. Plus, you'll be helping to support this show through that affiliate link as well. Don't let the sun set on your dreams. Listen, seize the day, folks. And if you have questions about what using Buzzsprout is like, reach out to us on Twitter or by email. You can tag me at @TheWellReadMage. Now go make a podcast!